You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest tonight is Julia Lee. Julia Lee is the author of Our Gang, A Racial History of the Little Rascals, a book which traces the history of the Hal Roach series of film shorts that ran from the silent era into the 1940s and featured a multiracial group of little kids. The book also details the impact of the series in a racially segregated America. Julia Lee, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
Race has been an issue in Hollywood since D.W. Griffith cast white actors in the roles of black characters in his famous 1915 film, The Birth of a Nation. And when sound was introduced to films in 1927, Al Jolson performed in blackface in the very first talking picture, The Jazz Singer. So how should modern audiences view these early films? Are they racist?
You know, I think it's important to look at it from the historical angle and to realize that, much of silent film was very indebted to minstrelsy. Vaudeville and minstrelsy were very popular theatrical forms. And so, you know, when the first silent pictures came out, they oftentimes just borrowed wholesale from these earlier theatrical forms. And so I think that's partly it. And, you know, obviously blackface minstrelsy is not common today or is not acceptable, socially acceptable. But it's important to remember that in the early part of the 20th century, this was not unusual. It was a very acceptable form of entertainment. And so something like Birth of a Nation, where you see white actors in blackface and often, you know, very clumsy, very kind of low-budge blackface, can be shocking to students today. I think it's interesting that with the advent of talking pictures, that was the moment where, yes, minstrel music and singing was still popular, but that was the moment where kind of like clumsy blackface entertainment, that was sort of the beginning of the end of that. So Al Jolson's Jazz Singer, you know, very famously shows Al Jolson as a blackface minstrel, but that was both the high point of minstrelsy's impact on pictures and also the beginning sort of its end, where it no longer became credible for a white actor to appear in blackface, and it actually allowed for more opportunities for black actors.
Right, because if you were going to have a black character in a talking picture, he had to actually be a black person.
Right, absolutely, absolutely. And there was also this this kind of fixation on the black voice as being somehow more resonant and more being a good fit for talking pictures. And so, in fact, ironically, it did increase opportunities for black actors once sound entered the pictures.
I recently saw Justin Timberlake in concert, and although he doesn't wear blackface, of course, he uses an African-American idiom when he performs, so is that all that different?
Yeah, I mean, I think of rock and roll historically, certainly contemporary music or just music in general has been very influenced by black musicians and black music. You know, you think about jazz, you think about the blues, you think about rock and roll in general, and how Elvis Presley, for example, was very much, you know, he was very influenced by black music. And I think that's something that's still an issue today, that there are, you know, not just Justin Timberlake, but somebody like Miley Cyrus or some of these other white musicians or white singers who are heavily influenced by black music and sometimes appropriate it without, sort of acknowledging their debt or being sensitive to those influences.
Right. I mean, is Iggy Azalea
yes,
less
yes,
racist?
Very famously.
Is she less racist than Al Jolson?
Right. I mean, you know, I think that's a good question. I think that, you know, I think there are critics who call her out on her kind of thoughtless appropriation. Yes, she doesn't paint her face black, but certainly she's, adopting or appropriating or exploiting a history without, you know, being knowledgeable or being attentive to or respectful of that history. So I think it is still very much a real issue.
So let's talk about the word racism, because I think it's an interestingly mm-hmm. misused word. I mean, in The Little Rascals, I should say the Our Gang short, A Lad and a Lamp, for instance, Spanky, mm-hmm. Spanky's holding, the kids are all looking for Aladdin's lamp because they heard about them in school. So they're all right. rubbing various various lamps and wishing for things.
Right.
And Spanky says, I wish I had a monkey. And then he looks over
right.
at, he looks over at Stymie's little brother Cotton and he says, mm-hmm. I wish Cotton was a monkey. All he need is a right. tail.
Right.
And Stymie says, careful what you wish for, that lamp might work. So
right.
would you describe that, even though it's hysterical,
right.
is it racist?
You know, I would say that that, I would say that that is racist in terms of, you know, sort of exploiting that stereotype of, you know, black people or black children as being like apes or monkeys or less evolved, you know, more primitive beings. And that really is, I mean, it comes across as innocent or naive because it's coming out of Spanky's mouth, but you also have to remember that the gag writers were adults. And so in some ways, yes, it's, you know, it's a visual gag. It's supposed to be all in good fun, but it, that kind of gag is building on a long history that, you know, was present with blackface minstrelsy. So it does make for some very uncomfortable moments. And that was a short that when it was eventually syndicated to television, you know, in the 70s, I think it was King World Entertainment, did eventually censor, that particular short because, of that kind of sight gag of a black child being indistinguishable from a monkey. All you need is a tail.
If you were to cut out the racially insensitive scenes in A Lad and a Lamp, you wouldn't have a short at all. You'd have nothing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, you know, another reason in some ways it's too bad in that some of these shorts become inaccessible. Oh, you know, you just can't, you don't see them anymore. You have to get the collector's edition to see them. So on the one hand, you know, I understand if you're having children watch them today, you want to make sure that they're not unwittingly absorbing these kind of racist assumptions. On the other hand, you know, I think it is important that they are available to collectors and to adults who, you know, may be interested and have more, are better equipped to understand the problematic nature of those shorts.
Well, you know, Julia Lee, we're so enlightened now, you know, we know so much better. So I guess racism must be completely gone because we're such enlightened people. But it's,
I definitely would not agree with that, but okay.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. And I mean, I don't know. There's a constant kind of big controversy about what it is that children watch and how it will affect them. You know, I grew up watching these shorts, and I also grew up watching the Three Stooges. And, you know, I didn't ever try to rake a saw across my friend's head or poke their eyeballs
right,
out.
Right, right.
So we don't necessarily embrace all the things we see on film. But I guess if we're seeing a lot of racially insensitive stuff, then we might be racially insensitive. But the thing that you point out so well in your book, and even on the cover photograph, there's this wonderful picture of all the little kids from our gang, including Petey the dog. And there's a little black child in there. And there was always a black kid in our gang.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely from its very inception. I mean, it was built as a star vehicle for a black actor, Sunshine Sammy Morrison. So absolutely from its beginning, it always had at least one. And in fact, originally it had two black actors who were part of the main cast.
And, you know, you mentioned Elvis Presley earlier, and Elvis Presley's original producer, Sam Phillips, had it in his mind that he wanted to break down the barriers of segregation with a singer like mm-hmm. Elvis Presley. Did Hal Roach mm-hmm. have a similar bent? Did he want to do this?
Yeah, you know, Hal Roach is an interesting character because I do. You know, I interviewed some people who were close to Roach, and, you know, in general, they don't think he necessarily had, you know, it wasn't a political statement, I guess I would say, or they would argue, you know, he was a producer, and he, you know, these shorts made money and were entertaining and charming. What I will say about Roach, though, is that he was known for being, not subscribing to, social beliefs that perhaps, he I think recognized that segregation was foolish and, kind of nonsensical, and all the stories that some of the former actors have, told either in books or some that I interviewed, they all said that Roach was an incredibly kind of open person. I mean, the cast was not segregated. The cafeteria, the commissary at the Hal Roach Studio lot was not segregated. Roach himself would not tolerate kind of racial insensitivity or discrimination on the part of some of the stage mothers. These are all stories that are consistent across various actors. So, Roach himself was a pretty kind of iconoclastic, irreverent, unorthodox kind of guy, and I think for him, he didn't care. He didn't see, black or white people as having to be divided or having to see them as somehow, seeing black children as somehow threatening. He did not see that at all.
Did Hal Roach, as the producer of the Our Gang shorts, did he exploit his black performers? Did he pay them less or treat them in any way less than his white performers?
No, in fact, it was hard for me to track down some of the pay stubs, but in fact, the black characters were paid comparably to the white characters or the white actors. And as I mentioned before, the series was founded was created as a starring vehicle for Sunshine Sammy Morrison. And Sunshine Sammy Morrison was the first black actor to be signed to a long-term contract in Hollywood. And this is a kid at the age of 8, first black actor signed by Roach. And Roach absolutely, valued Sunshine Sammy, in terms of he had a lucrative deal. All the Our Gang actors ended up, especially in the 30s, during the Depression, they ended up supporting their families with their wages, with their contracts. The one thing I did see I did see pay stubs for the later 30s, which was when Buckwheat, Billy Thomas, was a member of the cast. And that was a period in which the series moved over to MGM. And it seems that MGM was quite a bit less, I guess you would say, democratic or less. There was certainly more discriminatory behavior on the part of MGM when they moved over to the studio lot just down Washington Boulevard. At that particular point, what I found interesting was that Darla was the one who was paid the most, according to the records. She was the one, the girl who was a member of the gang, and she got paid far more than anyone else.
I wonder why.
I think she was, popular character. She'd been there a long time, and who knows? Maybe she had a very,
a special deal with
Louis. Stage mother, maybe. I mean, but as I said, it's hard to get consistent records. But during the MGM years, they did. USC does have some of the statements.
Well, and one of the things that's most interesting to me about the saga of Our Gang, or the Little Rascals as they were known on TV, was that when Our Gang comedies first began to play in theaters in the silent era in the 1920s, the NAACP admired the shorts and thought that they put forth a good image, and they showed black and white children playing together, and southern states hated them because they showed black and white children playing together.
Right.
And then in the 1950s, when they were on television, both the southern states and the NAACP objected to the shorts.
Right. I mean, this was a really interesting shift, in terms of cultural attitudes, in terms of the political climate. Absolutely. In the 20s and 30s, the NAACP actually held up the young black actors such as Farina, Hoskins, and Buckwheat as almost like racial ambassadors. They were positive portrayals of the race on television, in film, And as a result, they showed that integration was not such a scary thing. You know, these young black stars visited local black newspapers. They participated in NAACP events. but then in the, I would say, you know, it was syndicated to television in the 1955. As we move into the 60s, what you start to see is the show was banned, was boycotted by certain southern television stations, local television stations, because of the scenes of integration, which were considered unacceptable. And at the same time, you start seeing certain NAACP chapters also boycotting or calling for boycotts of the series, because rather than demonstrating, you know, integration and racial equality, they felt that the show was promoting racial inferiority among black children. So it became this interesting moment where people on opposite ends of the political spectrum, so southern segregationists and racists, as well as certain members of NAACP chapters, agreeing that the series was problematic, but for completely opposite
reasons. Sides of it.
Yeah.
Well, at the same time that they were objecting to The Little Rascals, the NAACP successfully brought Amos and Andy to an end, even though Amos and Andy on television was portrayed by black actors, not like it had been on the radio when it was
Right. Yeah, and I think that is a great example of how television, what's important to remember is that Amos and Andy was a national show, a national television show, and so the NAACP was able to successfully boycott or protest a national network. And so the network did not want to lose national sponsors, and so they caved. Now, Amos and Andy still was shown on television, on local television channels, and so you could still see Amos and Andy, you just couldn't see it on one of the major networks. Part of the reason that The Little Rascals was so difficult to, quote-unquote, boycott or protest or remove from the air was because it really depended on the local television market. These were syndicated shows, and so, you know, I mean, if you successfully boycotted, or, you know, the southern market successfully decided it wasn't, it was too problematic, then yes, you could, you no longer saw it on television in your local Birmingham station, for example. But if you were in, you know, the Northeast, you could still see it on your local television channel.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. Today we're talking with Julia Lee. She's the author of Our Gang, A Racial History of the Little Rascals. The Little Rascals had an extraordinarily long lifespan. They began as Our Gang at Hal Roach Studios in the early 1920s, and after a long run, they moved to MGM, where the series continued until the mid-1940s. Then, in 1955, they became the Little Rascals and dominated after-school TV programming on local stations across the country for years. The shorts often featured memorable musical numbers enthusiastically performed by Alfalfa. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking today with Julia Lee. She's the author of Our Gang, A Racial History of the Little Rascals. An attempt to revive the Little Rascals franchise resulted in a feature film in 1994. While entertaining, the film failed to capture the charm of the original, largely because it strove to be politically correct.
Right, yeah. I think that is part of the problem. And I also think viewers, or certain critics also, mentioned the fact that it seemed weirdly both, you know, updated, you know, in quote-unquote PC to reflect the, I guess, the movie version came out in 1994. So in some ways updated for 1994, but at the same time showed, it seemed a little bit anachronistic as well, because the kids are still playing with, you know, they're not playing Game Boys. They're playing with, right, you know, like their, you know, little
go-karts,
you know, makeshift fire engine, or, you know, and they're dressed as if they're like, you know, Depression era kids as opposed to early 90s children. So I think that struck certain critics as being sort of bizarre and also losing the, I guess, and I would agree with this, that, you know, this was a big Hollywood movie, and so it had a certain slick factor to it. You know, the child actors are cute, but they seem a little bit glib, they seem a little bit manufactured, and certainly they're professional actors, whereas the original Argang cast, some of them were professional actors, but a lot of them were just kids who were playing on the lot, and so I think that brought a kind of natural quality to the cast that Hal Roach, you know, really promoted, the sense that they were kids just being kids. They weren't studio kids. They weren't stage kids. They were unaffected and real. And I think there's some truth to that.
Well, you talk about an episode, and I think a lot of us have seen a lot of Little Rascals episodes, but I had never seen this one that you discussed until you told me about it, in which the gang, including, I think it was Farina at that point, had a Ku Klux Klan, their own version of the Ku Klux Klan.
Yes, this was a really, I mean, a crazy episode. I remember when I first saw it, it kind of blew my mind.
What would they call the Kluk Kluk Klams, right?
They were called the Kluk Kluk Klams. This is a silent film, so probably one that, I mean, certainly because of its content, probably would have been censored if it had been on television, although since it was a silent film, it likely was not part of the syndication package. But it's a fascinating short because it shows the kids participating in their own version of the Ku Klux Klan, except they call it the Kluk Kluk Klan, and it's an integrated fraternity. So you have Farina and Sunshine Sammy, who are officials in this lodge that is based on a racist organization. And what's hilarious about the short is that they're essentially making fun of the Ku Klux Klan and all of its, you know, sort of crazy rituals and its costumes. And so they're mocking that and showing just how absurd it is.
And that was the year that the Ku Klux Klan marched on Washington, the millions of them proudly marching with their burning crosses.
Right, it was all over the news. This was a resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan in the 20s. And you know, the KKK was also in the news here in I'm based in Los Angeles, and it was, you know, big news within the city because the Klan had infiltrated the Los Angeles Police Department as well, and so it was all over the LA Times, and certainly the gag writers at Hal Roach Studios would have been aware of this just from reading the papers, and so I think for them it was also, you know, a timely kind of issue to, you know, there was just built-in comedy. And so that ended up being, I mean, it's a very, very funny episode if you see it, even though at the same time it does also, once again, incorporate certain blackface minstrel moments, like there's a stump speech in it, and
they all end up shooting dice.
Yes, exactly, and sort of butchering, you know, their English and all this kind of stuff. But that particular film was really interesting in that you actually had theater owners writing in and complaining that the Ku Klux Klan was boycotting the showings of Lodge Night in the theaters because they recognized that the Argang writers and actors were making fun of them, and they were not thrilled with that. And so certain parts of the South, certain places, Klan strongholds like Kansas, for example, boycotted that particular short when it was in the theaters.
What a shock. Did you track down and watch all, you know, 50,000 episodes of the Little Rascals?
You know, I was able to track down most of them. I mean, some of them, for example, the very first episode has been lost. The very first short that was created, you know, I was able to track down some that they managed to find, you know, I think some you'll find, you know, a silent, one of the original silent films that had been dubbed into German or something, and somehow they have a copy of that. So I also saw one that had been dubbed into Spanish, one of the silent films, which was a hoot to watch because, you know, or not, it wasn't dubbed, actually. The kid had to memorize their lines in Spanish. And
They had to recite it.
They memorized them phonetically, yeah.
I think
the early talkies.
I think there's a few Laurel and Hardy shorts where they have to speak Spanish and they don't know what they're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, and Hal Roach, you know, was, I think, a little bit overly confident that the kids would learn Spanish really easily. And, you know, Laurel and Hardy could learn it fairly easily, went to classes on the Hal Roach lot, but the kids, it was a lot more difficult.
Well, Dr. Lee, your book, Our Gang, A Racial History of the Little Rascals, is new to me. I just kind of discovered it a couple of months ago. But I guess you wrote it a couple of years ago.
Yes, I did most of the research a few years ago.
And just before I tumbled onto your book, I had just read this current bestseller by Timothy Tyson, The Blood of Emmett Till. And the story of Emmett Till, the 15-year-old African-American boy who was lynched in 1955, is also in your book. Can you...
Yeah.
How do you draw a correlation between Emmett Till and the Little Rascals?
Yeah, I mean, this is also something that that the book is interested, you know, sort of looks into the way that the media, you know, sort of representations of young black children, especially black boys, in the media, and sort of how one of the reasons why the Little Rascals managed to be so popular, despite the fact that it showed integration at a time when integration was not necessarily accepted in many parts of the country. Part of the reason it was accepted was because these were children, and that black children were less threatening than black adults, and young black boys, and sadly this is one of the effects of blackface minstrelsy, is that the young black boy was a trope of blackface minstrelsy, the young black comic, you know, child. So in some ways a mainstream American audience was very familiar with these types and was very more willing, I guess, to accept a young black child as an innocuous and kind of funny creature than, say, an adult, specifically a black teenager or a black young man. Now, with Emmett Till, the Emmett Till murder happened in 1955, and this was a seminal moment for the civil rights movement. You know, Mamie Till, the mother, insisted that her son's lynched body, I mean, he was unrecognizable from the violence, but insisted that there be an open casket at his funeral because she wanted the world to see the brutality of Jim Crow and of lynching in the South. And this became a moment that, I mean, you have everybody from like Muhammad Ali and, you know, to all these, pretty much every young person in the black community remembers the moment they saw those pictures because it brought it became very explicit the kind of violence and danger they were in. So the moment of Emmett Till's murder was also the same year that the Little Rascals, or Our Gang, was syndicated to television as the Little Rascals. So it becomes this interesting moment of seeing how a black child is figured in television, in photographs, in film, and how you realize that this young black boy, Emmett Till, was, I think he was actually younger. I think he was made of then 13, had just turned 13 years old, and yet was considered this threat. And, you know, recently it was discovered that, you know, he had purportedly whistled at this white woman. And in fact, she's still alive. The woman admitted that that was a lie, that he had never whistled at her at all. And the fact that somehow he was demonized and lynched for his breach of Jim Crow codes of etiquette when he is a child, I think that becomes really important to the story because it also shows how these young black children at a certain point, and at what point is that? I mean, a 13-year-old is still a child, suddenly becomes threatening and could be murdered for nothing. I mean, Emmett Till did not do anything, and he was murdered.
Yeah, it's and so you're in your book, you talk about how the little rascals reemerge right at the moment of the civil rights movement.
Yeah, and I think that's another interesting convergence, because you start to see how television becomes this medium that, you know, there have been a lot of sort of media scholars that have talked about this, how if it were not for television and the fact that the networks started covering the civil rights movement, covering things like the Emmett Till murder and covering things like, you know, the protests and the marches and freedom rides, if they hadn't covered this, the nation itself would have remained in the dark about some of these issues. And in some ways, the civil rights movement was able to maximize on new media, on television, in order to kind of gather support for their cause and to make it clear that this is a question of good versus evil. I mean, it's very easy to see that, you know, when you have these nonviolent protesters being abused and beaten by Southern segregationists, you know, it becomes very clear it's a good versus evil story. And in some ways, The Little Rascals was doing the same thing in many ways. I mean, part of what's so appealing about The Little Rascals is that it's a kids' show. It's very clear who the good guys are. It's clear who the bad guys are. And in some ways, the adult world tends to be, you know, full of the priggish, you know, judgmental, you know, the folks who don't want the little black and white children to play together. And it's the kids who manage to have this innocence and this open-mindedness that the adults don't have. And so, yeah, so I do think that the fact that Southern segregationists then started panicking when they saw episodes of The Little Rascals, because they realized that in some ways they thought of it as propaganda, you know, that it was propaganda showing that integration wasn't such a bad thing, and television was an incredibly powerful medium. And so in some ways, trying to eliminate it from television was a way to prevent people from being won over, quote-unquote won over, to the side of integration.
I'm sure more people saw The Little Rascals on television than had ever seen Our Gang in the theater.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you think about how, you know, there, in terms of television, in terms of kids' shows that were on television in the afternoons, I mean, you know, we didn't have the hundreds of cable channels that we have today. So kids coming home from school on an afternoon, on a, you know, weekday afternoon, there wasn't necessarily that much selection, that many things to see. And so they would watch The Little Rascals, and then their parents would often remember seeing The Little Rascals or seeing Our Gang in the theaters. And so for them, it was a nostalgic experience. And so sometimes parents would watch with their kids and, you know, feel that this was good, old-fashioned fun. And, you know, especially during a period when, you know, you've also got anxiety about, you know, Russia and the atomic age and things like that, The Little Rascals seemed very comforting.
Gary Shapiro, you're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. Today we're talking with Julia Lee. She's the author of Our Gang, A Racial History of the Little Rascals. So the Emmett Till case really exemplifies that, you know, racism is no laughing matter. And
right.
And then at the same time, so we come back to this thorny issue of what's racist and what's not. In 1964, 1965, when Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. were at their Rat Pack peak, they were often doing Amos and Andy kind of bits,
right,
you know, and you know, I think Dean Martin would hold up Sammy in his arms and say, I want to thank the NAACP for this award or something like that.
Right.
And then in the 80s, you had Eddie Murphy and his Buckwheat character.
Right.
Again, which... Is one more racist than the other, or one more racially insensitive than the other, or are they both,
you know,
in the same?
There's, you know, and people still talk about this, about how, you know, people decry, and oftentimes comics decry this PC culture because you can't make racial or ethnic jokes anymore because somebody's bound to get offended, and, you know, why does humor have to be inoffensive in some ways that destroys humor? That is certainly something. I mean, I've heard Seinfeld has made comments about that, and I would push back a little bit on his kind of, you know, why can't you? You know, I think it's complicated, and partly it's complicated because it depends on the comic who is cracking the jokes, and it's also complicated based on the reception of the jokes, because you have to imagine that if it's a, you know, sort of an audience that is all white, versus an audience that might be in on the humor versus an audience that might not recognize the humor. I think this is part of Eddie Murphy's issue, is that he was kind of making fun of these racist stereotypes, but then at the same time finding that audiences were laughing a little bit too hard at his Buckwheat impression. And so then his fear became, do they realize that this is actually me making fun of this stereotype? And in fact, I think he realized that part of his audiences, you know, some of his audiences didn't realize that he was, that it was tongue-in-cheek, that it was satire, and that, in fact, some of them just saw him playing a clown and, in fact, just saw him as kind of another Sambo figure. I think often about, I think it becomes a very complicated, and I think this is one of the reasons why Eddie Murphy, for example, did end up retiring his Buckwheat caricature, despite the fact that it was very, very popular and, you know, that one of the hit Saturday Night Live skits or sketches.
Take a whiff. Unt. Ties. Be time to mate.
Yes, they're all here.
Who can put nub in all the wrong places? Who can put nub?
Once Buckwheat sings a song, it's eternally his.
It died, dead a diver, then on the died, it died. Man a day behind.
Eddie Murphy as Buckwheat on Saturday Night Live. And Julia Lee, you go into some detail in your book, Our Gang, A Racial History of the Little Rascals, about how lots of young people were wearing Buckwheat t-shirts with the image of Buckwheat on it without really understanding what the image of Buckwheat implied.
Right, yes, and I think that becomes difficult too, because it's like, are you just using him as a mascot? You know, sort of, and again, just seeing him as like a comic figure to be laughed at, or do you realize the subversiveness of Eddie Murphy's humor? I mean, there's the novel, I don't know if you've read The Sellout, which just won the Booker Prize.
I have to look at it.
The Sellout is written by Paul Beatty, I believe is his name. And he talks about, I mean, he has an actual figure in his novel that is based on a kind of Buckwheat character, you know, a fictionalized figure like Buckwheat, who appeared in The Little Rascals and who was known in his book as Hominy. He calls him Hominy. And I think
that was cereal that they didn't use in the thing.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, and I think Beatty is talking about how this is a really antiquated, you know, kind of minstrel stereotype, and that, you know, in some ways, you know, I think he would argue that that in some ways it just perpetuates, you know, it's satire, but and the entire novel, I mean, The Sellout is an extended satire, but he talks about how, you know, this Hominy character decides he wants to be a slave, you know, and it's sort of, it becomes this uncomfortable thing where it's like, oh, and he poses as a lawn jockey, and he starts to imitate all these racial stereotypes from the past, and you can't tell And in some ways, it seems like he's buying into those stereotypes. He wants to be those stereotypes rather than, you know, he's not mocking them.
Well, there's another question, and I wonder if people ask you this all the time. You are Julia Lee, and if someone sees a picture of you, they see that you are not, in fact, African-American, but Korean-American. Are people surprised when they meet you that you're not African-American and that you're writing about these topics?
You know, I think there is some degree of surprise. I also teach African-American literature, and so, you know, certainly when I first enter a classroom and my students see me for the first time, they're not all the time, but sometimes surprised because they sort of assume that, you know, you have to look like what you teach. You know, so they're sort of like, oh, this is a black literature class. Why is my professor not black? And, you know, I've written a little bit about this because it brings up the question, well, you know, that black literature is something that I have studied and that I respect enormously and I find really moving and I've been trained in. And in some ways, you know, saying that you have to look like the literature you teach brings up this question of, well, so then does that mean I cannot teach Shakespeare because I'm not a white Englishman? You know, it brings up these kinds of questions about, so what does it take in order to teach a literature? And I guess what I would say is that, and part of this is in the book too, is that, yes, I'm Korean American. My parents were immigrants who moved to Los Angeles in the 70s. And I grew up not far away from Hal Roach Studios, and I grew up watching The Little Rascals on television. And I also grew up during the L.A. riots. I was, you know, a teenager when the L.A. riots broke out in the early 1990s. And so in some ways, the racial history of the country is something that I've always been interested in, and also I'm a part of. I'm a part of this, quote-unquote, melting pot and this question of how do people of different backgrounds get along or not get along. You know, my parents were small business owners who, during the riots, were worried that their business was going to be burned down. And there was all this talk about black Korean racial tensions and the Soonja Doo, you know, when she ended up receiving only probation for the murder of Latasha Harlins. I mean, these were very, very hard questions. And you know, I think it's something that I, as an American, but I also as a Korean American, and as somebody who is deeply, you know, finds African American literature, just a profoundly moving literature, and African American culture profoundly moving, it's something that I feel I must learn and try to be attentive to in order to kind of figure out my own place, you know, and how to navigate racial difference when, you know, more often than not, it seems that the history of race in the country oftentimes seems like it's getting worse rather than better. You know, it seems like there's some progression, but then there's some regression and then more progress. And I think we're at a moment right now where it feels like we're moving backwards. For me, I think this is a critical moment as a person of color in the classroom to kind of deal with these questions and to make black culture and black literature something that, I mean, it's not just for black students, and it shouldn't just be for black students. It should be for all students to try to, I mean, we have to confront these issues if we're going to try to understand one another better and kind of move forward.
Well, shockingly, we have not answered all the questions about race today, but I want everyone in the world to read this book. It's called Our Gang, A Racial History of the Little Rascals, and the author, my guest, the brilliant Julia Lee. Thank you so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. This is great.
That's it for this week's episode of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, please check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Julia Lee. Her book, which is published by the University of Minnesota Press, is called Our Gang, A Racial History of the Little Rascals. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.